The shiur today is dedicated by Yefrid and Chaim Mandel in memory of Lee Goodstein, Olav HaShalom. I want to continue with the commentary of the Barbanel on the first Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. We're going to learn a few more words in the Mishnah with the Barbanel's commentary, but I'm going to enlarge on this Mishnah and in what we're going to speak about, go off on a tangent a little bit, to speak about something that is relevant to this week's Sedra, and relevant also to a Shalom Zachar, since I get a Mazel Tov that my son had a boy last night. Oh, which reminds me, since it was last night, he did what I told my children they're not allowed to do, and that's to have children on Monday. Unless it's a girl. Which means that next Monday, Im Yirtzeh Hashem, I may not be here because I'll be at a bris. So, however, we are working on perhaps changing the time for the shiur, exchanging it with something else, making it later. First, let me find out. If we make the shiur later, instead, what I'm thinking of is to exchange it with the video presentation, which is at 12:30. How many of you would be able to come here at 12:30? How many would not be able to come here at 12:30? How many don't care altogether? Is there a what?
Not that we wouldn't be able to come. We're here already. So what are we going to do between...
No. There'll be the video presentation would be at 10:30 and this will be at 12. What? I hear. What about if we change it to 11:30? Instead, those two shiurim changed. What? I can do that. I'm just kidding. If we switch that from...
Whatever.
Okay, what I see is that there is some room for latitude, and if something could be changed, that may be a possibility. Okay, but barring any possible changes, I probably will not be here next week. Okay.
It's a good reason.
No. Next. Okay, so just check. I will also check to find out if I'm going to be here or not, and you should also check to find out. Okay. Okay, the Mishnah says the following. Moshe kibel Torah misinai u'mesora liyoshua. Last week we explained the Abarbanel on the first phrase, Moshe kibel Torah misinai. What does it mean that Moshe received the Torah from Sinai? And the Abarbanel learns that it means the following. Moshe Rabbeinu, unlike all other Talmidei Chachamim of all the generations, Moshe Rabbeinu did not learn Torah the way it's normally learned from someone else, needing all of the preparations to learn and whatever. But Moshe Rabbeinu was infused with Torah by God, but he had to be fit for it. So why was Moshe Rabbeinu chosen to be the one that God would infuse the Torah in? Because Misinai, because he was the one who went and contemplated and thought and secluded himself on Har Sinai when he tended the flocks of Yisro, and because he put in a tremendous amount of effort to think and to ponder and to prepare himself, he became a vessel that God could fill with Torah. That is what the Abarbanel says. That's Misinai, from his seclusion, secluding himself and concentration at Sinai way before the Torah was given. That's what made Moshe Rabbeinu fit to be the person that God chose to infuse with Torah, to fill him with Torah. Now we'll go on to the next phrase, Umisara li Yehoshua, and he gave it over to Yehoshua. So the Abarbanel asks, Lecha'ora, there was even a greater person in the time of Yehoshua, who could have been entrusted, the Torah could have been passed over to him. And that was Elazar Kohen Gadol. Aaron, HaKohen's son, Elazar, was the Kohen Gadol after Aaron died, and he was a very, very great person. So why did Moshe Rabbeinu give it to Yoshua and not to Elazar Kohen Gadol? Says the Abarbanel, because Moshe Rabbeinu, first of all, could have given the Torah over to his children, but he didn't, because they weren't really fit to have the Torah given to them. Not that they weren't fit, that there's something wrong with them, but they were not the people who put in the tremendous effort to be the people who were fit, the most fit, to receive the Torah. Torah goes according to effort. The ikar of Torah is not what you know, how much information you have, but it's how much effort you put in. In Bechukosai, Telechu, Shiyu, Amelim Batorah. Torah demands a tremendous amount of effort. We're talking now about Torah Shebal Peh, the oral Torah. To learn the oral Torah, you need to put in all your concentration and all your kochos. And it's a tremendously toiling and omoviyagia, toil and tremendous effort has to be put in. And the one who puts in the most effort, the one who toils the most, is the one who is fit more than the person of a higher station or whatever, or even of greater intellectual capacity. And therefore, even though Elazar Kohen Gadol may have been greater than Yoshua, Yoshua, Moshe Rabbeinu chose, and God chose, that Yoshua should be the next one in the line of the ones who transmitted the tradition, because Yehoshua, the Gemara says, Yehoshua was the one who set up the chairs for Moshe Shir. He's the one who cleaned up, swept up after, and he served Moshe Rabbeinu with tremendous effort and tremendous toil. And Chazal say, Gadol Shimusha Yosar Melimuda. Serving a Talmud Chacham is even greater than learning, because you put in that effort, the toil. You immerse yourself totally in that Talmud Chacham. We'll get to explain all of these things in a second. First, let me just tell you what the basic, what the Abarbanel says. So that's what he says. That's why Umasara Yehoshua. That's why Yehoshua was chosen to be the successor to Moshe Rabbeinu in handing over the tradition of the Oral Torah, because he put in more effort. He was the one who was more involved in the receiving from Moshe Rabbeinu than anyone else. Okay. Now, I want to speak about this idea from a few different vantage points. Some of them will have to do with the Sedra, and some, like I said, to do with a Shalom Zachar. It all fits together. Let's start with something that has neither to do with the Shalom Zachar or the Sedra, just a concept. Why is it that effort in Torah, and especially the oral Torah, is the most important thing and not the knowledge per se? The Gemara says, "Im yomru lochem chochma bagoyim tamin." If someone tells you that goyim possess wisdom, believe them. There's much wisdom amongst the nations of the world. Torah b'goyim al tamim. But if somebody tells you that the goyim possess Torah, don't believe them. Now, that can't be taken literally, that a goy can't possibly have Torah, even though a goy is not permitted to learn Torah, but there's goyim who do things that aren't permitted to do. Right? So there are a lot of goyim that learn Torah too. And there are goyim that learn in seminaries, priest seminaries, right? They learn Mishnah, they learn Gemara. There's even a priest, a minister, who wrote a commentary on the Mishnah. And so goyim, right, do learn Torah. What are you going to tell me? Well, they don't really learn it properly, and they can't understand it. That's also impossible to say. I'm sure that a nuclear physicist could open an art scroll, Chumash, and make heads or tails of what it says there. So Goyim both are capable of learning Torah, and even though perhaps they're not allowed to, they do it anyway. So what does it mean categorically if someone tells you Torah by Goyim, the Torah exists by the nations of the world, don't believe them? The answer we always say is prefaced with an anecdote. Bertram Russell was a professor of ethics at City College in the 1940s. And during that period of his life, he was what the world considered at the time unethical. He was an avowed communist. He was the 1940s, and he was a supporter of free love. He didn't believe in marriage. So even according to the standards of the Goyim of the time, he was not a very moral, ethical person. So the ethics committee of the college called him in, and they said, Professor Russell, we have a problem with you. You are the professor of ethics in this institution, and you're not ethical. He said, what's the problem? He said, 20 years ago, I was a professor of mathematics in a school in England. I taught geometry. Not once did the ethics committee of the college call me in and say, Professor Russell, we have a problem with you. You teach geometry in our institution, and you're not a square, a circle, or a parallelogram. I don't have to be what I teach. I just have to teach it. I don't have to be a plane to teach geometry. I don't have to be ethical to teach ethics. That was his answer. Chachma is something you possess. It doesn't necessarily have to have any effect on your personality, on your morals, on your behavior. It can. There are many fine, wise, non-Jews or Jews, secular knowledge, who their knowledge made a tremendous impression on them. And they were very fine people, but it didn't have to. You can be the same nuclear physicist, the same politician, the same author, and be a terrible person. One author, American author, comes to mind in literature for sure. There are plenty of people who were great people of literature, authors, and were very, very immoral people. But one American author comes to mind, who I won't mention, who wrote very fine books, won prizes. But if you tripped over him when he was in a drunken stupor, right, with the next beach bum next to him, you could never tell the difference. But when he was sober, he wrote good books. I said I wouldn't mention the name. Okay. And there's a long, long list. And probably the most positive thing he did for society was commit suicide. But in any case, there's a long list of authors from many countries over thousands of years, and it's not only literature. You can be a fine politician and be a maneuver. You could even be the President of the United States and be an immoral person. For what's it called? Oh, the President of Israel, for that matter, right? And it doesn't affect one bit your prowess as a politician, and your prowess as a politician does not affect one bit your personality. They are two separate areas. The Torah can't be like that. Torah, the Gemara says, Torah is compared to fire. Ma'esh osaroshim, aftorah osaroshim. Just like fire makes an impression, Torah has to make an impression. And if it doesn't make an impression, then it's not Torah. Either are people who perhaps are not the way we would like them to be in their morals or in their behavior, and yet they seem to know a lot of Torah. So let me tell you that you go to a wedding, and on the men's side, they have a liquid that you put on your hat, and you light it on fire, and the hat doesn't burn. It's a very cool flame, some kind of alcohol or whatever, and they dance around with the hat burning, and the hat doesn't burn. Right? Just like the snash and nenu ukol.
Oh, my niece did it in
the
ladies.
Huh?
My niece did it in the ladies.
Oh, okay. I was wondering, since I never dance in the ladies section, which is not really true, because by my son's, my daughter's weddings, all the brothers would go into the ladies section and dance around the kala. Because in many of the cases, they didn't bring the kala to us, because they're too frum, so we decided the boys can go and dance by the kala in the other side of the mechitza. In any case, so, but I didn't really have a chance to see how the women were dancing, that for sure not. But I understand they do it on the women's side too, obviously not on their hat, and I assume not on their hair either.
No, not on the
I think, okay.
I
hear. In any case, what's the point? The point is, you can have something that looks like fire, smells like fire, sounds like fire, but it's not fire. It's fake. How do I know it's fake fire? It doesn't burn anything. The same thing, you can have something that looks like Torah, smells like Torah, sounds like Torah, but if it doesn't make an impression on the person who learns it, it's not Torah. It remains wisdom. It's plain, ordinary wisdom, looks like Torah. It stayed Torah. It's not real Torah. And therefore, for a person to have real Torah, it has to make an impression. Torah has to be like fire. Has to make some impression as to Torah is not information. It's transformation. It has to transform you into something different, into a living Sefer Torah. And that is what a Talmud Chacham has to be. A Talmud Chacham has to be a living Sefer Torah. To the point where the Gemara says how foolish people are. That they stand up for a Sefer Torah, but they don't stand up for a Talmud Chacham. The Sefer Torah is a dead parchment with dead Atzei Chaim that sits in an Aron Kodesh the whole week and doesn't do anything. The purpose of that Torah is to be infused in a human being who will become a living Sefer Torah. So people stand up for the dead Sefer Torah, but they don't stand up for the living Sefer Torah. So that is what Torah is. And therefore, Torah, a good portion of the Torah, most of the Torah, is oral. That you shouldn't be able to think you can curl up with a book and get information and learn Torah. But you have to learn it from a living person who personifies the Torah. In Doma HaRav L'malach Hashem Tzavakos, Yivakish Torah Mipiu. If the Rav personifies Torah, then you're allowed to learn from him. And if he doesn't, you shouldn't learn from him. And therefore, Torah, when you learn it, you realize it has to be part of life. You're learning it from a living person who personifies and embodies the Torah. And therefore, Torah has to be learned with a tremendous amount of omol and yigia, with tremendous amount of effort and toil, because then it becomes part of you. If you just get information easily, you just integrate information within you, then it doesn't have to change you. But if you have to horava, you have to really put omol and yigia, effort and toil in it, then it has a much greater chance of making an impression on you and transforming you into an embodiment and personification of Torah. So that's one of the reasons why the Torah needs tremendous amal and yagia, needs tremendous effort and toil. Now that we've explained that, and therefore the one who puts the most effort and most toil, and it's not just in the learning itself, but in all of the Shimusha Torah, in serving a Talmud Chacham, who you learn from him how to embody the Torah, and serving him and seeing his being is what made Yehoshua the one that was fit to pass over the Torah to the next generation. Because he was the one who put in that effort. He was the one, says the Abarbanel, who put in all of that toil, who served Moshe Rabbeinu, who ministered to Moshe Rabbeinu, who set up the chairs, who swept the Beis Medrash. That's how you become a living Torah. Now, let's take it to the next step, something to do with the Seder. And have faith in me that this has something to do with the Seder. In the beginning, it's not going to seem like they have anything to do with anything. It's to do with the Seder, not with what we're talking about, but I promise you it has something to do with what we're talking about. when HaKadosh Baruch Hu first informed Moshe Rabbeinu that he was redeeming the Jewish people, so he told him he's taking him out of Egypt, taking him to Eretz Yisrael, and that's it. But when he sent him to Paro, he told him to tell Paro they're going 3 days in the desert to make sacrifices, and gave the impression that they're coming back. That never happened. They didn't go 3 days in the desert and make sacrifices. They left. Paro got the impression that they're coming back, and he chased after them. Why did God lie? Why did God misrepresent what was going to happen to Paro? God commands us not to lie. Why did he lie to Paro? So there are various answers. I'll give you some quick answers and then get to the one that I want to speak about. The answer I'm not going to tell you today is my answer, because it has nothing to do with Pirkei Avos. But the answer I'm going to tell you is from Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, and that one does have to do with Pirkei Avos. But let me tell you two answers first from the Rishonim. The Ramban says that this was part of Paro's, this was in order to get Paro to get to the Yamsuf to be drowned. God punished Paro in kind. They drowned our children, he was drowned, or the Egyptians were drowned. And in order to be drowned, they had to get to the Red Sea. Now, what was going to get Paro to get to the Red Sea was not an invitation. Please come to the Red Sea, I'd like to drown you, wouldn't have worked. So the Rabbanu Shlom needed some mechanism to get Paro to the Red Sea. So what he did is he told him that they're going 3 days in the desert to make sacrifices, and then he thought that they're coming back. And when 3 days passed and they weren't coming back, he got really upset and chased after them, which brought him to the Red Sea and drowned him. That's what the Ramban says. The only problem with the Ramban is that God could have thought of a more honest way of doing it. First of all, he could have brought the Red Sea to them. Right? He could have drowned them in the Nile. Could have drowned them in his bathtub if he wanted to. I mean, there was a lot of other ways than getting him to run after them to come to the Red Sea. So why did God do it, Dafka, with this subterfuge? Says the Or HaChaim, I call this another dimension. He says, because this was part of Paro's punishment. He wasn't only going to be drowned. That was only part of his sin, that he drowned our children. But he also enslaved us. And he enslaved us through guile and subterfuge. Perah. He didn't come and say, we're putting all the Jews now into slavery. But he said that he wants patriots to come and help build some store cities. And he himself showed up to help build. He wanted patriotic Egyptians. The Egyptians ignored him, and the Jews showed up. Who are the most big patriots? I want to show that they're great patriots of their country. Jews. So the Jews all showed up to help Paro build these store cities. And this went on for a week or 2 weeks, and then all of a sudden Paro's not there one day. Another day they show up to work, and they're told they have to come back the next day. The next day they come back, and there's people with whips behind them, and slowly but surely Paro tricked them into becoming slaves. Now, it's a very bad thing to make somebody a slave. But it also is an extra thing to fool people into becoming slaves. Because when you're fooled, you feel like you've been had. You feel like a fool. And that makes the punishment even greater. It's not just a servitude, but we were fooled into it. We were tricked into it. You feel like a fool. So therefore, Paro had to be punished not only by being drowned, and not only by all the makos, but he had to be fooled into it too, that he should know what it means to feel like a fool. So God did this on purpose because that was part of his punishment. That's one answer. Another kind of answer, and that is, there's a question, when God hardened Paro's heart, what was he doing? The Rambam says he was taking away his free choice. He couldn't repent anymore. He was being punished for everything he did up until that point. At that point, God could have killed him. And that was it. He deserved already to be killed. But God didn't kill him at that point, which he could have done. He let him live, took away his free choice, took away the ability to repent, and used him as a pawn to make God's point to the world. So Paro was punished for everything he did up till that point. He wasn't punished for anything after that point, but he was used as a pawn, and that was the reason that God hardened his heart. Other Rishonim say just the opposite. God wanted Paro to have free choice, to be able to repent, but not to be forced. No normal human being could have withstood the pressure of the Makos, of the plagues, and not been forced to listen and let them go. So therefore, God hardened Paro's heart to equal the playing field, to make him able to withstand the pressure of the Makos in order that he maintained his free choice. That's another opinion. If that's the case, that the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted Paro, till the end, to be able to choose, to be able to willingly let them go, to make a conscious choice, then it makes sense that God came to him, not asking him, let all your slaves go forever. That was something that Paro could not have agreed to. It was beyond his free choice. It was an offer he could not accept. So therefore, the Ribbono Shel Olam said, let's start with something small. Let's start with 3 days in the desert. If Paro will agree to that, then mitzvah gereres mitzvah. Then saying yes will make it easier to say yes to the next thing. That's what the Palestinians do to us all the time. Wear us down. You know, agree to this, then we'll agree to the next thing, and the next thing, and the next thing. Once you're saying yes, you get on a roll of saying yes more. So God made it possible for Paro to agree by only presenting him with a 3-day journey in the desert, and then if he would agree to that, then we'll go on for more negotiations, right? And till he would be presented with letting them go for good. Okay. Those are two answers that are given. Now I'm going to tell you a third answer from Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky based on a Yaros Devash, Rabbi Yonason Apeshitz. He says the following. He says that, and you're wondering, what in the world does this have to do with what we started with? You'll see in a few seconds, a few minutes. The Yaros Devash answers the question the following way. He says the Jewish people really were supposed to be in Egypt 400 years. They were only there 210 years. Had they been able to withstand the whole 400 years of slavery and affliction, it would have served as a smelting pot. When you smelt gold or silver, you take away all the dross and you're left with pure silver and pure gold. That's what was supposed to happen to the Jewish people. They were supposed to be 400 years in slavery and be smelted to be purified their neshamas. And they would have left Egypt pure, ready to receive the Torah on the highest level, would have gone to Eretz Yisrael and been there forever. The Beis HaMikdash would never have been destroyed. That would have been the ideal. But after 210 years, God saw that the Jewish people, many of them, had descended to the 49th level of Tumah. They were assimilated. They were serving idolatry. They gave up Bris Milah. And he realized that if he leaves them another 190 years, there's not going to be any Jews to redeem. They're going to be gone, most of them. So therefore, the Ribbono Shel Olam said the following. Either I can take them out now, but then there's 190 years left that are unfulfilled, that will have to be fulfilled with other exiles over thousands of years. Because the 190 years that were left were on the seed root level of the Jewish people. Whatever is in the root is a miniature of what comes out in the plant. So if on the root level you need 190 years, on the developed level you need thousands of years. And that's what happened. We had to make up for those 190 years through all the other empires and exiles that we went through till today. But God said, you know, I would rather leave them there for the next 190 years and finish all of this in Egypt. But I can't the way they are. So therefore, I want to take them out for 3 days in the desert for a Shabbaton. A nice Shabbaton. And we have Moshe and Aaron who can speak to them, and I'm sure they would bring in other speakers or whatever. And, you know, a lot of ruach, and we'll sing and dance and really give them the shot in the arm. That after those 3 days, for these people, again, we're talking on the root level, every little thing can make a difference to them. After a 3-day Shabbaton, with sacrifices and with speeches and whatever, and maybe they would have gotten some mitzvahs, we're going back to Egypt, and spend the next 190 years, but that shot in the arm would have given them the ability to continue. If Paro agreed, then that would have been the plan. Paro didn't agree. Not only that, he made things worse for them. So God said, okay, I'm going to consider the worse as if they were here for the next 190 years. Not exactly, because they're going to need more exiles, but they're going to go out. Because Paro didn't, had Paro agreed, then they would have gone for 3 days, come back, spent the other 190 years in Egypt. That's what the Yaros Devash says. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky says that's exactly what happened by Golus Bavel. Same thing. Really, when we went into Golus, the Babylonian Golus, we were supposed to be there till Mashiach comes, not 70 years. But God saw that after 70 years, the Jewish people forgot the Aleph Beis, many of them. They were assimilated. They had married Goyim. And if he waited longer, there wouldn't be any Jews to redeem. So they needed a shot in the arm. Therefore, he didn't redeem them. When we left Bavel and came back to Eretz Yisrael in the time of Ezra, it was not called the Geula. It was called the Pekida. It was just a shot in the arm, a long Shabbaton for 420 years. Because now we're dealing on the developed level, not on the root level. So they needed 420 years with a semblance of a Beis HaMikdash. It wasn't really a real Beis HaMikdash because the Shechina was missing and the Aron was missing and the Luchos were missing. It's like a shul. Doesn't have an Aron Kodesh. Doesn't have a Sefer Torah. There's no Shechina there. But it looks like a shul. No, it'll give you a little feeling of nostalgia. Right? So it was a Pekida. And therefore, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, many of the things that were done during those 420 years were a preparation to go back into Golus. It was a break in the Golus to go back from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael, and therefore, who went back? Mostly the weak people who needed that shot in the arm, not the stronger ones. The stronger Talmidei Chachamim stayed in Bavel because they knew this is not a redemption. We're going to have to go back into Golus, and we don't need it. We don't need that shot in the arm. So they stayed in Bavel. And that's why during this period, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, many of the laws that the rabbis made, the siyogim la-Torah, the fences around the Torah that separate us between the non-Jewish world, we don't eat things cooked by a non-Jew, wine touched by a non-Jew, things that socially separate us were instituted during those 420 years in preparation for going back into Golus to be able to survive. And one other thing, and this is the connection, one other thing that became during Golus Bavel, right, during that period of time when we went back to Eretz Yisrael, was after the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, even though the oral Torah was given on Sinai, but it was handed down, Moshe to Yoshua, they were the ones who basically were involved in protecting it, preserving it, promoting it, and handing it over. It wasn't in the hands of the Hamon Am, of the populace. That changed after the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. Till the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, it was handed over to a group of people who preserved it. After the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, it became the property of all Klal Yisrael. Everybody learned Torah Shabbat Peh because that was part of the way of preparing to go back into Golus. They needed that toil and effort to be able to survive the Golus. Every Jew needed to put in that toil and effort in Torah Shabbat Peh, which transformed them into Torah beings, Torah personalities, and that way they could survive the Golus. That's what Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky says, and he adds another dimension. He says that's what happened in our time. In our time, after the Holocaust, the Rabban Shalom saw that the morale of the Jewish people was so low. There were people who wanted to hide their Jewishness. They were just tired already of being persecuted. And there are people who never told their children they were Jewish. They moved to places where they were Goyim. They pretended they were Goyim. They brought up their children as Goyim. And some of them found out on the parents' deathbed that they're really Jews. But many, many Jews like that. Not just Jews who went through the Holocaust. Jews who saw what happened to other Jews in the Holocaust. And God saw that the morale of the Jewish people is at such a low ebb that there wouldn't be too many Jews left when Mashiach comes. So he give us a shot in the arm. That shot in the arm was called the State of Israel. We're able to come back to Eretz Israel, and it was mainly not for the people who were strong in Yiddishkeit. They didn't need it. They had the Torah to be their identity, but Jews who didn't have the Torah, and they didn't want to identify with the Jewish people because of their low morale. So God gave them something to be proud of. We have a state, State of Israel, and many Jews who don't have Torah and mitzvahs, but found the pride in Jewishness in the State of Israel. And that was one of the reasons why the Rabbanu Shalom permitted Yidden to go back to Eretz Yisrael. It wasn't a geula, it's not redemption, but it's a shot in the arm that will keep many Jews going until Mashiach will come. That wouldn't have kept going without this. This was really true up until the Yom Kippur War. After the Yom Kippur War, unfortunately, many of Jews who are weak and not Torah-oriented don't get pride or strength from the State of Israel, just the opposite. They're ashamed of it because they consider it like the leftists of the world, or most of the world look at it, where they're a bunch of conquerors and occupiers and sadists and whatever, and they're ashamed of the State of Israel. Right? The people who are not connected to Torah all the way to the left, unfortunately. And that started from the Yom Kippur War and on. But before the Yom Kippur War, what he said is 100% across the board, this gave Jewry, the people who were weak, the people who were not necessarily affiliated with Torah, something to be proud of. It gave them a shot in the arm that hopefully will last until Mashiach comes. In any case, so this is the idea of Amelus BaTorah, why the Torah Shebal Peh, during the period after, what's it called, after the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, during the time of the return to Eretz Yisrael, after Golus Bavel, became widespread because it was needed to give that shot in the arm. And that's the toil that a person puts into Torah, transforms him, gives him the strength to go on. Okay. Now let's connect it to a Shalom Zachar. All this is the same idea, and it's all why Yehoshua was chosen to be the next in line, because he's the one who put in the toil and the effort. So now, I just want to remind you what has to do with Pirkei Avos and the Avar Benel. Okay, now let's get to the Shalom Zachar part. The Friday night before a bris, you're familiar, there's a minik to have a Shalom Zachar. Okay. One of the reasons for a Shalom Zachar, I'll tell you two of the reasons, and we'll put them together. One of the reasons is that the baby was saved from the mother's womb. Okay, shenimlat mimei imo, and health with health, and we celebrate that. So first of all, then we should do it for a girl too. Girls also saved from the mother's womb. We should celebrate the fact that a girl was born healthy also, not only boys. Another reason. Another reason is that before you go to the bris, it says that the bris is like a sacrifice. Any animal is born, it has to be 7 days before you can bring it as a sacrifice. Only on the eighth day can you bring it as a sacrifice. And the reason the Zohar says that at least one Shabbos has to pass by before you can bring an animal as a sacrifice. Because Shabbos is like, first, before you go to see the boss, you have to see the secretary. Shabbos is like the secretary. And the Rabbanu Shalom is the boss. So before you become a sacrifice and see the boss, you have to see the secretary, which is Shabbos. Same thing, bris milah is like sacrifice. Before you can have the bris, you have to have a Shabbos before. That's the Shabbos before, and we celebrate with the Shalom Zachar. Obviously, that only applies to a boy. Then there's a third reason. I'm going to put all these reasons together in a second. The third reason is that a child learns Torah in the mother's womb the entire 9 months with a malach. A malach teaches a child Torah. Right before he's born, the malach hits him on the lip and he forgets everything. So we come the first Friday night after birth to console the child in the fact that he forgot all his Torah. Nichum Aveilim. We come to console the mourner. He's mourning for all the Torah he lost. We come to console the child for the Torah that he lost. Those are three reasons. Now let's see. Two of them don't seem to make any sense. First of all, the fact that a person was saved from his mother's womb, as if being born is something positive. Do you know the Gemara says that the best time of a person's life, the most serene, right, the most ideal is those 9 months that he's inside the mother? It says that a candle burns at his head. Some people say that's why women have heartburn when they're pregnant. But it doesn't mean a real candle, obviously. It's a euphemism. There's a light at the head. You can see from one end of the world to the other. The child is learning Torah. He's serene. Even without all of this, right, most people sleep in fetal positions because they have this wish that they wish they were back there 9 months inside their mother, right? And most people would love to stay like that for the rest of their life. So, what do you mean you're saved from the mother's womb? Just the opposite. You came into a really cruel world. It'd be better if you stayed where you were. So what are we celebrating? The child was born. Secondly, it says that we come to console the child for forgetting his Torah. The halacha is that if you have a mourner and you want to console him, you don't go on Shabbos. Only if there's no other time to go, you can go Shabbos. But otherwise, the koshi tiru nichum aveilim Shabbos. It's with great difficulty that you're allowed to fulfill the mitzvah of nichum aveilim on Shabbos. So if they're making this to console the mourner, the child who lost his Torah, why do we do it on Shabbos? Shabbos is not the proper time to console mourners. And this is specifically Shabbos. The answer is the following, I think. And it all fits together. Yeah, a person would be very comfortable in his mother's womb. Stay like that for 70 years. Some mothers feel that their children could do that even out of the womb for 20, 30, 40 years, whatever, and remain completely dependent. But that's not what the purpose of the world is. The purpose of the world is that a person should perfect himself and not be born perfect. You come into a world which is imperfect, and the purpose of the world is to put in the effort and the toil to perfect yourself. That's what this life in this world is all about. Because if God could have created you perfect and put you in Olam Haba, why did they put you in this world? Put you in this world to perfect yourself. And that's the whole idea of a bris. You're born imperfect and have to perform. Why didn't God just create us perfect? Mole. Circumcised. Why did he create us that we have to do that to ourselves or to have a parent do it to you? A mole do it? Because God put us in an imperfect world. He wants us to perfect ourselves. And it's sometimes painful, and you have to be moser nefesh, and it's like a sacrifice, but that's what life is all about. That's what the world is all about. So therefore, by a boy where it's obvious that he was born imperfect and has to perfect himself through the bris, so we first let him see a Shabbos. Shabbos is the goal. Shabbos is Olam Haba, the world to come. That's the goal. But we're not giving it to you on a silver platter. We want you to earn it with your own work and your own toil and your own effort, because that's what this world is all about, putting effort and toil into things, because otherwise you don't need this world. So we let him see first the Shabbos. This is the goal, but we're not going to give you this Shabbos unless you put in a lot of work. First you need 6 days of work till you get to the next Shabbos. So then it understand what the bris is all about. Why you need that sacrifice? Why didn't God just create me perfect? So the Shabbos of being celebrating that you were saved from the mother's womb, even though that was very comfortable, but you're not in this world to be comfortable. You're in this world to put in effort, to perfect yourself and the world around you. So we celebrate being born, even though it's not as comfortable as not being born. That's one lesson, and therefore, it all goes together, so it's only by a boy. Only by the boy do you have all the things together. And that gives him the understanding of why there has to be a bris. Why couldn't God have created us already perfect? Why do we have to go through it with all the pain or whatever, and the blood? Because that's the purpose of this world. So the Shabbos before the bris, first you see the secretary, first you see what the goal is, but then you realize why you're making that sacrifice. And the mail, it answers the other question too. I guarantee you that the rabbis would permit the following kind of consolation of a mourner. What's a regular consolation of the mourner which is not permitted on Shabbos unless it's dire circumstances? Person dies, and you come to console the mourner. What do you say? Look, no, it's a tragedy, the person died, whatever, but, you know, God is good, and there's a reason for it, and you have to get back to life, and you can't let this, make you disabled or whatever. You must get back into life, and that's the consolation. Remember the good times, whatever, or whatever people say by Nichum Avelim. That Nichum Avelim has a tinge of sadness, a lot of sadness to it, and therefore it's not proper on Shabbos. But this kind of Nichum Avelim, I guarantee you, would be mutter on Shabbos. Somebody comes to the mourner and says there's been a terrible mistake. The person you're mourning for is still alive. He's not dead. There's a mistake been made. Right? I guarantee you, you're allowed to do that on Shabbos. Okay? That kind of consolation is 100% okay. There's no tinge of bitterness in that at all. That kind of consolation, there's no problem doing on Shabbos. Everybody agree? Okay. That's what we tell the child. The child is mourning for the Torah that it forgot. First of all, the Maral says, if you want the child to forget Torah, first of all, why in the world would a malach get a job to teach a kid Torah for 9 months and he knows every single one is going to forget it totally afterwards? Why did God give this malach a job that has no purpose to it? Secondly, the Maral says, why does the malach hit him on the lips? You don't remember with your lips. You should hit him on the head. That's why you forget. Why on the lips? Says the Maral, it's not that the child forgets all the Torah. The child retains everything, potentially. Because if you didn't learn Torah from a malach as you were developing, you could never learn Torah after you were born. Because Torah is something that has to transform, has to go into your being. It's not something you just learn knowledge. It has to be something that permeates you. So it has to be learned from a malach. It's like putting something at the hard drive of a computer. But it's only potential. Then you have to access it. Where is the point of access? Here. What's outside is actual. What's inside is potential. The malach hits him here to keep everything on the inside potential. And now you have to bring it out by accessing it with your toil and your effort. That's the purpose. So we come to tell the child, you didn't forget the Torah. It's there. What you were given is the opportunity to access it yourself through your own toil, and that's the purpose of existence. Just like not being in the mother's womb is maybe more comfortable, but that's the purpose of life. Put in the effort. And just like the bris, weren't born with a bris. You have to do it. You have to perfect yourself. Same thing with the Torah. The Torah is there. The main thing is how much toil and effort will you be to access what you have, what was infused into you. That's what Torah is. And therefore, the one who puts the more toil, the one who puts the more effort, is the greater one, not the one who has the greater potential. Because we all have potential. Question is, who realizes that potential through the effort of learning or whatever? And that's why Yoshua was chosen, says the Abar Benel, over Elazar Kohen Gadol, because even though Elazar Kohen Gadol made him greater, but Yoshua put in more effort. That's the one who is more significant. Yeah. Probably a girl learns the Torah, so gay to her. Even Goyim probably learned Torah in the womb too. It says that the shamas of Gerim are from the time that they are created supposed to become Jews, and therefore sometimes a ger is held responsible for delaying. So therefore that neshama learned Torah also, in anticipation of one day it will be a Jew.